Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts for teens. These teen podcasts are by teens and for teens. They run the gamut from author readings and music performances to discussions and book reviews by the Teen Center advisors. These podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation with the help of the library's teen advisors. To learn more about our teen programs, including how to become a Teen Center advisor, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the library by volunteering or supporting its foundation, go to www.foundation.spl.org.
I'm Marcellus Turner, City Librarian of the Seattle Public Library. Welcome and thank you for joining us on such a beautiful day for a very special afternoon with Walter Dean Myers, our third National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. Today's event is made possible by the sponsors of The Post, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute. We thank the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs and our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis. Thanks, as always, to Elliott Bay Book Company for helping present this afternoon. And finally, this event is sponsored by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. The foundation represents thousands of people in our community who give gifts, small and large, to benefit our libraries. That private support is what makes possible so many of our free library programs. So to the foundation donors here with us today, we want to say thank you very much for your support. The position of National Ambassador was created in 2008 to raise national awareness of the importance of young people's literature as it relates to lifelong literacy, education, and the development and betterment of the lives of young people. The National Ambassador for Young People's Literature is named by the Librarian of Congress for a two-year term based on recommendations from a selection committee representing many segments of the book community. The Center for the Book in the Library of Congress, the Children's Book Council, and its foundation, Every Child a Reader, are co-initiators and co-sponsors of the National Ambassador Program. In January, Dr. James Billington, Librarian of Congress, appointed Mr. Myers the third National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. His term runs 2012 through 2013. He succeeded Katherine Patterson, who is best known for her Bridge to Terabithia, and the first appointee, John Sheska, author of books including The Stinky Cheese Man and Other Fairly Stupid Tales. Walter Dean Myers was born August 12, 1937, in Martinsburg, West Virginia. His name at birth was Walter Milton Myers. At a very young age, he was given away by his father to Herbert and Florence Dean, who lived in Harlem. He later added the middle name Dean in their honor. There weren't many children's books in the Dean household, but by the age of five, Walter was learning to read through other materials he found at home. Walter Dean Myers is a critically acclaimed author of books for young people. He has written more than 100 books, and his award-winning body of work includes Sunrise Over Fallujah, Fallen Angels, Monster, Somewhere in the Darkness, and Harlem. Mr. Myers now lives with his wife in Jersey City, New Jersey. His youngest son, Christopher Myers, illustrated his father's book, Shadow of the Red Moon. The most recent father-son collaboration is We Are America, A Tribute from the Heart. The format for today is an on-stage conversation. Mr. Myers' interviewers are teens from the Seattle Public Library's teen advisory groups. They are, and we'll ask them to raise their hands when I call their names, and you should know they put me through a little bit of a test to try to figure out which one was whom before we started. And I had only one gentleman, and I thought I could get that correct, and of course I did not. But we have Aldo, who is a 10th grader at Ballard. We have Christina, who is an 11th grader at Franklin. We have Ellie, who is an 8th grader and is homeschooled. And we have Khadija, an 11th grader at Franklin. We have Maddie, who is a 10th grader at Ballard. And we have Rebecca, who is a 10th grader at Garfield. And we have Georgia, who is an 8th grader at Asa Mercer. And now I ask you to join me in a welcome to Walter Dean Myers to Seattle. Thank you.
Okay, so my question is, what do you hope to accomplish during your appointment as the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature?
I believe that what we need to do is to revisit the idea of universal literacy, in which we get all young people reading, not only reading occasionally, but reading well. When I was a young man a few years ago, life was quite different. In the Harlem tenement in which I lived, there's one man who worked in the post office, and everyone else worked either in a factory or as a laborer. And they were all able to support their families doing that kind of job. I can envision in the future a large building with 100 computers in the building. One computer will regulate traffic for the city. The next will do medical testing. The next will do will design tools. The next will design curricula in schools. And there will only be two live beings in the school, in the building. One will be a man, and the other will be a monkey with a baseball bat. The man's job will be to feed the monkey, and the monkey's job will be to keep the man away from the computers. The point of this is that the kinds of jobs that existed, and subsequently the way of supporting your family and sustaining yourself, is those ways are no longer there. Now, you can be a willing worker, but if industrial jobs are not there, you can't support yourself. So what's needed for everyone is, number one, to be able to read well enough to learn the new kinds of jobs, and also to learn a new job every 5 years. Because whatever job you have today may not exist in 5 years. And so you have to be able to read. So what I hope to do is to have some very serious discussions about reading and how reading will impact the lives of all Americans, and as well as national security.
Okay.
Okay. So my question is, what do you like to read, and what are you reading right now?
What do I like to read? I normally read a number of books at the same time. So what I'm reading currently is a book by Shirley Bryce Heath called Ways with Words, in which she discusses the differences in vocabulary between two towns. I'm reading a book called What Work Is. It's poetry, really interesting poetry, by Philip Levine. And I'm just beginning to read a novel by Paul Auster.
Where does your inspiration come from?
Where does my inspiration come from?
Yes.
I don't have any inspiration. I have nothing inspires me. I have things I want to write about, and the things that I'm interested in are actually no different than what you are interested in. You see things around you in the world, and you have an interest in them. I see things going on around me, I have an interest in them, but I have the advantage of being able to write about those things and expressing that interest. It was a hobby. You know, I would like to say that, you know, there was a light, the clouds parted, and this light came down, and a big hand reached over and plucked me in the butt. It never happened. It was a hobby. I had, growing up in Harlem, I liked two things. I liked basketball, and I liked reading. If I could have made it in basketball, I wouldn't be here today. I'd be doing something else. I also had speech problems growing up. I went to speech therapy for 10 years, a speech impediment. And it's a genetic thing. When my brothers and sisters came to New York, they had the same kind of impediment. So I spent a lot of time either on the ball field or by myself reading. And after a while, I began to write also.
So who taught you how to read? Did you teach yourself?
When I was very young, I guess three and four, my stepmom, used to read with me when she finished the household chores. And she was the kind of woman who would wash everything that could be washed, iron everything that could be ironed. But when she finished, she would read. And what she liked to read was true romance magazines. So she would sit with me, and she would read with her finger going across the page. And I loved that time with her. I loved being with her when she did that. Eventually, by the time I was five, I could read some of the words also. And by the time I was six, she could do the ironing, and I would read to her. And so it was just loving that whole sharing thing with my mom.
Who are your favorite authors for teens and children books?
I know, I would say, most of the writers who have been around for a while, and I like a lot of them. I like Richard Peck. I like Sharon Creech, Sharon Flake. I went to school with Avi, Chris Crutcher. I mean, there's so many of them. You know, if people ask me my favorite author, there are so many good authors out there producing so many good books. I like a lot of them.
And so do you have a specific favorite book?
No. I mean, because I might read a book today and I will really enjoy that book, but next week I may read another one which I really enjoy. Oh, I read one 2 weeks ago which I spit on and threw against the wall. Now, I hated the book so much, but, yeah.
What advice would you give to a young person who wants to be a writer?
So what you're asking me, if I understand the question, how can I help you to compete with me? I worked with a young man 2 years ago, about three and a half years ago. He emailed me, and he said he liked my books, and he also said he wanted to write. And what I believe that I can do with anybody, anyone, maybe not you, but is to teach structure. I think what makes a good writer is living well and reading well. If you are sensitive to the world around you and you have read enough so that you can use language, you can write well. What's missing with most writers is structure. Now, I worked in the publishing for 7 years, and when I worked in publishing, I noticed some writers who were making a living, and they were not that good as far as I was concerned. And what I came up with is that people who can make a living at writing, who are successful, have mastered structure in some way. So you have to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. You have to have that. So with this young man that wrote to me, I said to him, let's try structuring a book. Let's try the pre-writing process that I do. And I do it very formally. I do a very formal pre-writing thing. And once that pre-writing is done, once that structure is created, then what's next is, who are you? Are you an interesting person? If you're an interesting person, I'll read your book. But it's the structure. Learn structure. If you were going to build a house, you would not start by building a bathroom. Yeah, you would. Maybe you would. But you will learn the structure of the house. You will learn how to build a foundation of the house. If you were making a car, you would do the same thing. Writing, unfortunately, when we're taught English literature, we're very often taught that Shakespeare, Keats, Yeats, these people are geniuses. And we think, well, if I'm a genius, I don't have to work at this. But you do have to work at it. It's a very long answer, but learn structure. Learn structure. After that, everything's up to you.
Was there a certain moment in your life that made you a writer or made you know that you wanted to become a writer?
Yes, in a way. I dropped out of high school at 15. I got caught, put back in. Dropped out at 16. Joined the Army at 17. Got out of the Army. I had no skills, but I could shoot people. And that's not a bad skill to have in New York, believe me. No, not true. I had no skills. I was like a lot of the young people, young men and women. I was reasonably intelligent, but I had no skills, and I had no entree into the job market. So one day I was working on a job, and I was tearing down buildings, which I'm fairly good at. I was a sledgehammer man. And we had a lunch break, and during this lunch break, we were sitting on the curb, and some ladies came walking by, and one of my co-workers made a few intelligent remarks, like, "Woo, woo, mama," something to that nature. And they looked at us with such disgust and with such disdain. And I understood then that I needed to do something more with my life. I needed to find a path. And I remember a teacher in high school who said to me, when she knew I was dropping out again, "You write well, don't stop." So I said, let me go back to that. And I went to the writing, not to make a living, but just to feel better about myself.
Thank you.
Why do you write books for young adults and not fellow adults like yourself?
When I was 12, I was considered very bright. Oh, he's so smart. Look at him. I was considered very bright. But at 12, my family began to disintegrate. My my uncle finally got out of jail, and he was out of jail for like 9 months before he was murdered. We sent my father into despair. My mom, who had been a borderline alcoholic, been all up to steep in. So now there I am with this completely dysfunctional family. Some interesting things happened to me. My grades plummeted. My grades went. My life was so miserable at that point. So that point of my life was so important to me. So that when I began to write as an adult, I keep going back to that for two reasons. One, that was so traumatic to me. And the second reason was I think I understand what's going on with many kids who face similar problems.
Thank you. What is one of your books that you're most, that you find that you're most achieved, like your book that you're very proud of, one of your most books that you're very proud of, like your favorite book out of all the ones that you wrote?
I don't have a book that I'm very proud of. I mean, the books to me served a particular function at a particular time. I was in middle school. I was doing volunteer teaching in the middle school, and the kids was in that middle school were saying so many negative things about themselves that it really hurt me. And so what I did, I went out and produced a book called Brown Angels, and I was trying to show those kids their own beauty. So at that particular point, I liked that book. I did a book called Now Is Your Time, which I did to show that black heroes are not unique. They come from black families. They come from families. You know, who you are, is you come from your family. And so that particular book... but basically, why I write, I was I was researching a book, and I spoke to a defense attorney, and I asked, he was telling me what his job was and what he did every day, and basically, he was defending the poorest people. Who came through the criminal justice system. And I said to him, well, you know, it must be very difficult for you to acquire the funds to defend these people. And it must be difficult to do the investigations. He said, that's not my core job. My core job is to humanize the people that I write about, to humanize them. He says, when the prosecutor presents his case or her case, they will try to dehumanize my client. They will say things like, people have the right to walk the streets as if my client was not a person. Citizens have a right to this as if my client is not a citizen. They will try to separate that person from the jury. And his job was to present his client as a human being. And I came away from that very much impressed. And my job as a writer is to humanize the people that I write about, to humanize them. I need to humanize the 2 million American children who live in poverty. I need to humanize the 5 million American children who have a close relative who has been incarcerated. I need to humanize the children who lead lives which are close to desperate. And my ability to do that is what I am most proud of.
So you basically make books for specific purposes and for specific people? Like different book, like different generals?
It depends. I mean, if I meet you today, you may say something that triggers a book. And I'll just steal your idea. I mean, I'll just use that idea.
Okay, so when you wrote your book, Kick, you wrote that with a teen author, right?
Yes.
And so when you were writing that, how did that make you feel? Did you, like, enjoy it? Was it, like, a good experience to write with a teen author?
I have so much faith in young people and their abilities. So I worked, when I first worked with Ross Workman is the young man that I worked with in writing. He was 13 when we started this book. At that point, I was working with three groups. I was working with a group in Irving, Texas, of 10 young boys who were middle school kids, and they were mentoring younger boys. And I worked with them on doing family histories. I was working with a prisoner in the Bronx, and I worked with Ross. And I enjoy working with young people. I enjoyed the experience. I enjoyed seeing how they progress. With Ross, it was difficult because while we were doing the book, he started off at 13, and then by the time the book was finished, he was 16. So he's maturing as a writer, but he's also maturing as a person. So we got to the end of the book, close to the end of the book, and he became very discouraged because he said, "Oh, the stuff I wrote early on is just terrible." Well, naturally, he's going to think that. He was only 13 when he started writing the book. You know, so it was a wonderful experience for me, and I learned a lot from him. I learned a lot.
Okay, thank you.
So, Walter, before we started, you were talking to us about the book that you are beginning to work on, about the young man in Mississippi who bought a kit and built a plane. Can you tell us about that?
One of the things that happens to me is that people read a book and then they'll send me ideas, they send me photographs. I collect photographs. I have 10,000 photographs. And the 10,000 photographs are of mainly African-American life from 1850 until 1940. But they also send me ideas. I was in the shop, and a guy came up to me and said, "Are you the guy that writes books?" And I, guilty. And his uncle fought in the Italian-Ethiopian War. And he was from Gulfport, Mississippi. The Gulfport, Mississippi, he wanted, you know, 1911, he saw airplanes in the sky for the first time, and he wanted to fly, and he was determined to teach himself to fly. He actually bought an airplane kit. You could buy a kit, you know, and he bought a kit, built it in his backyard, powered it with a motorcycle engine, and flew it. He kept on teaching himself to fly. He got a job as a janitor for an aircraft company. When the Italians invaded Ethiopia in 1934, Haile Selassie understood that the Italians had an air force, a small Air Force, but it was an Air Force. And he understood that he could buy a few planes, but he had no one to fly them. So he sent his emissary to the United States to get pilots. And they looked for black pilots. And this was one of the guys that they found. And he went to Ethiopia, and he taught Ethiopians how to fly, and he flew reconnaissance missions for the Italians.
This is going to be a book for young people?
This is going to be a book for young people.
With photos?
What?
With photos.
With photos. I have about 50 photographs, which my wife is now working on colorizing.
I don't suppose you'd tell us the book that you threw across the room.
There was a book by V.S. Nepal, which I can't stand him anyway. But,
but I guess you will tell us.
but I thought I would read his book, and I read his book, and I did hate him. You know, and so I spit on the book and I threw it across the room.
You know. Is there anything more that you want to say about what we understand to be your, what you've decided is sort of the role of the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature for yourself? The reading is not optional.
Right. I'm seeing throughout the world, I live in New Jersey. I live in New Jersey 10.5 months a year. 6 weeks a year, I live in London. And I see something going on in London, and I also see it in United States, wherein we're giving up on those people who can't read. You know, in London, what they're doing now is recommending that kids as young as 14 take vocational tracks. If they want to take a vocational track instead of an academic track, and I don't think kids are ready to decide a vocation at 14. They're also thinking of dropping the A levels, which are the regents, which are the equivalents of our regents. But I think we're doing that in the United States as well. I see so many kids failing. Our high school dropout rate is outrageous. It's outrageous. And it falls most heavily on minority groups and poor people. And there are reasons for that. There are absolute reasons for that, which are not tied to race or economics. Not directly to economics. But I think we're ready to give up on that because the job looks hard and we're walking away from it. So I need to have that discussion open. I need to have that discussion at every forum that I go to. Reading is not optional. If you can't read in today's world, what's going to happen? You're going to suffer. When my boys were young, I would make them sit down and read the marriage announcements. I would say, look, girls who go to college want boys who go to college. Girls who go to 2 years of college want boys to go to at least 2 years of college. They don't want dummies. And the thing about it, there's no place for you in our society today if you can't read. Life has changed. We need to keep that in mind and keep it out there. Every time I hear a kid say, books are boring, I think we failed that kid. We failed that kid.
So whom do you have to convince of this?
I need to convince everybody. What happened when I started with this National Ambassador thing, my medal. Thank you. I saw so many people who are have access to money, who have whose hearts seem to be in the right place. They say, "Oh yes, we can produce books, and we can get books to children," but they don't believe in the kids. They don't believe in the kids. They don't believe that the kids and the families are going to take up the struggle. And if the families don't take up the struggles won't work. You can't impose education on people. It has to be a cooperative effort.
Like, what kind of book would you give to somebody who doesn't like reading? That's not one of yours.
In the first place, I have to convince that person that reading is not optional, that you don't have to like it, you have to do it. You have to do it. You know, if I told you that for you to be able to walk, you have to my wife just had her knee replaced, right? She's not here, I can talk about her. And so she had her knee replaced on March 19th. And the doctor told her, says, when you go home, you're going to have to exercise that knee. Either you'll exercise that knee, or you won't be walking. And it's the same thing with reading. Either you learn to read, and you learn to read well, or you will suffer. You will not be able to have the flexibility to get jobs. I mean, if you meet my grandson, plays for the Harlem Globetrotters, and he couldn't read, you wouldn't need him. No, I mean, you wouldn't need him. I mean, you have to be able to read. So this idea, I want to get away from the idea that, oh, books can take you to faraway places, and books can take you on wonderful adventures, because that sounds like books are a pleasant adjunct to your life. I don't see it that way. For me, opera is a pleasant adjunct to my life. Mm. I like opera. You know, prices are a little too high, but I don't mind. But I can do without opera. I can't do without reading.
I bet some of you have questions. You want to come to the front and ask them? Don't be shy.
Hi, my name's Kathy, and I'm a juvenile correction officer. And I just purchased your book, On Lockup.
Right.
And I appreciate the work you did, I'm sure, with the kids. But tell us some of your experience with kids that are incarcerated.
When I started interviewing adults, and I would go to maximum security prisons, and I'm talking to these men and sometimes women. And then I began to realize that most of these people have children. I'm saying, what's going on with your kids? So I began going to the juvenile prisons. And what I'm seeing is the idea that many of these kids are virtually illiterate. They cannot read. They have very bad self-images. They have lives in which they are virtually living on their own, even though they may have a place to stay. That's something else. They can't tell you what's going on in their lives because they're ashamed of it. I mean, when I was a kid, when I was 15 years old, and I would come home, and somebody would say to me, "Your mom's lying on the sidewalk around the corner." I would want to hit that person. I'd be so angry that they knew that was my mother, and I would go pick my mom up. I was a big kid. I'd pick my mom up and bring her home, and I was ashamed of it. And sometimes I wouldn't go to school, and teachers would say to me, "Well, Walter, what's wrong? What's wrong with you? You have to get yourself together. You're a smart kid." And I wasn't going to say, "Oh, but my mom's a drunk." And my house is so dysfunctional, I can't come to school. And so what I did, I stopped going to school altogether. And many of these kids who come up with these very flippant answers, they don't mean to be terrible people, but we need to intervene somehow. And I'm just finding so many kids who are just going in and out. There was a kid that closed down Spofford in the Bronx. That was the prison that Mike Tyson was in. And the New York Times said, I got nothing against the New York Times, but the New York Times said that they're trying to do alternate sentencing. So I spoke to some judges. I went to a meeting of 100 black men, and I spoke to some judges, and the judges said, yes, that's in the New York Times, but they're shutting down that funding as well. So to give these kids alternate sentencing is not happening. I was in a prison in Knoxville, Tennessee, and I spoke to a judge there. He used to be a football player. He used to play for the Minnesota Vikings. Big dude. And he was saying that sometimes he wants to give a kid a break. And he would say, he would call the mother or write a letter to the mother and say, come in and we'll talk about maybe giving this kid a break, what he has to do. And the mother wouldn't come in. And, you know, some of the stories are heartbreaking. You can't take them all home. You can't take them all home. You know, it's just, and you know, there's don't get me started here. there's something else going on, too. And that is, for every prison, now, there were about 100,000 kids across the country in prison. Many of them, not many, but some of them have life sentences at 15 and 16. But there were also group homes, kids who have been abandoned. There's maybe 500,000 kids in group homes. And they stay in the group homes until they're 18, and then they age out. And then they're just put out into the streets. I mean, it's kids in America, it's kept quiet, but you know, there's a lot of problems.
Thank you for sharing, Mr. Byers. My name is Mertis Thompson, and I've been a writer most of my life, but I never had any encouragement or someone to say to me, why don't you pursue that? That never happened, so I had to inspire myself. So my question is, did you have encouragement, or were you in a supportive environment that allowed you to keep going?
No, I didn't. You know, I did not have that environment because no one in my family, but my father couldn't read or write. You know?
Okay.
And that was a tragedy for me because I didn't know he couldn't read or write until he died. But he never mentioned anything that I had ever written, even though I would publish stories that he told me. And I would give him the stories, hoping for some little encouragement. When I first began writing, since I had no encouragement from my community and from my family, I wrote as a white person. And so I wrote for white magazines. I wrote stories on bullfighting, and I wrote for Alfred Hitchcock. I wrote for Red Book. And it wasn't until I read Jimmy Baldwin for the first time that I was encouraged to write anything about my own neighborhood.
Okay.
And I spoke to Baldwin, and I told him that story, and he said that he had had a similar experience because his father, who was a minister, did not particularly approve of his writing. And so what he did was to go to Europe. And, you know, and it's even harder for young people today because magazines don't publish fiction anymore. So it's even more difficult. And it's, you know, one of the things that I would like to do, I'm trying to do, I worked with Ross, I worked with these kids in Texas, I worked with a kid in the prison, but I'm trying to start a magazine back in New Jersey. I'm trying to hook up with a university to get young urban kids writing. And they're not being encouraged. They're not being encouraged, and I hope to do something about that. And I have the money now. I'm old. You know.
Thank you.
Right.
Hello, Mr. Myers. My name is Drago Little, and I teach sixth grade through graduate school here in Seattle. I work for a program called Rainer Scholars, and we have like a 14-month academic boot camp where we get the kids ready, and then we send them off to APP from prep school. And I also work with what's derisively called regular kids in the community. And one of the things you said earlier is you have to organize the families.
Right.
And I'd be curious to know, like, well, what would your ideas be about that? Because one of the problems I always have for kids who want to apply to attend the program is I ask them, well, what do your kids read? Because one of the first books we read is Richard Wright's Black Boy. And if you don't read well, that book is going to put you in the dirt. So how would you go about trying to get more families on the reading bandwagon?
Well, what I'm trying to do is to... Well, first of all, Jeffrey Canada, a friend of mine, Jeffrey Canada, has a program in which he brings in families to read.
Yeah.
But what, you know, 25 years ago, the guy at University of Chicago, what was that guy's name? Alan Bloom,
yeah.
Had the Great Books program.
Well, that was Mortimer Adler, but he was part of it, yeah.
I'm sorry?
It was Mortimer Adler.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what I would like to do is to find a great books program for teenagers. But somehow I have to divorce that program from the grading system. Now, because once you bring that into the grading system, the kid begins to see it again as an opportunity to fail. What I did... in New Jersey, I bought 600 books and gave them to anyone who agreed to read it with the child. Now, what I'm dealing with some financial institutions now, and what I would like very much to do is to start a dialogic reading workshop in the YMCAs.
Okay.
See, but if I get that in the YMCAs, then, okay, so what I'm trying to get Bank Street College in Columbia to provide teachers to teach low-level readers to read, to babies, from between the ages of 6 months and five years. Mm-hmm. Now, I can get the funding for that, and I'm pretty sure I can get the funding for it, and I can get the space for it. I just have to get through the bloody red tape. The bureaucracy is like stilting. Okay, then I would like to get some program which involves older boys and girls.
And girls.
Older boys and girls and the family. But what I would like to do is to somehow get some incentive to the family. If I can do that. Now, someone recommended doing it through the church. That didn't seem to work for me because I tried that with the church, and I got a lot of lip service. So I'm looking for a way of getting some sort of reward for books read within the family. I don't know if I can do it. If you have any ideas,
well,
man.
The only reason why I mention that is funny you say partnering with the university, because people like Alan Bloom when they learned how to run seminars. In the old days, the University of Chicago ran great book seminars for the public.
Right.
So they're PhD students. There's nothing better for a PhD student than have to run a seminar on mice and men with a bunch of truck drivers,
right,
and
right,
janitors and right, whatever. So that's how they got their experience running seminar. And it's interesting you hear to say that, because I run two literature seminars here for middle school and early high school kids. And so far, over 3 years, my kids have read like 80 books, but I can't get them school credit
right,
for reading, you know, the books with me. So it's a nationwide problem. I was just curious to see.
Yeah, and that kills me, because, you know, if you could do that and get those kids school credit for it,
yeah,
That would be, yeah. I'll come up with a way.
Okay, so.
I'll give you, don't leave without my address.
No, I won't. Because the other thing is, and what I find interesting is, so I talked to the guy who is in charge of the local accreditation system for the private schools.
Right.
So my private school kids who participate in my seminars, I can literally send a single letter and they'll get credit for doing the seminar. The public school kids, I have been emailing the district for 2 years. And I've had 5 meetings. I'm like, the kid read Great Expectations for fun. Like I don't understand what the problem
okay,
is.
Okay.
So we'll talk.
Okay, good.
All right. Well, we wish you, Walter Dean Myers, all success in your efforts. And thank you very much for coming and spending the afternoon with us. Thank you very much. And thank you to all of your teams.
Thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your generous contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.